start.
This is Small Business Conversations on PBN, brought to you by Profits Plus Solutions, increasing your profits plus building your business for the future. We are Profits Plus. You can find us at profitsplus.org. This is Small Business Conversations on PBN, the Profitable Business Network. Now, the host of Small Business Conversations, principal of Profits Plus Solutions, here is Tom Shea.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Small Business Conversations for Thursday night, October 20th, 2022. Glad that you can join us, whether you are with us live tonight or whether you are listening to the recording. We know that this has got a lot of people's attention, and we were very surprised to find this. So let me go through the necessary announcements and get ready to bring on our guest, and we'll start talking about business. Tonight's Small Business Conversations is being recorded. It will be available on the profitsplus.org website as an MP3 and an MP4 file so that you can click and listen or download to a personal device if you want to hold on to it, or you can just pick it up live through any of your favorite podcast services. They include Amazon Music, Anchor, Apple Podcast, Breaker, CastBox, Castro, Google Play, iHeart, iVox, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Pocket Cast, Podbean, Radio Public, Stitcher, Verbal, Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, and yep, that's about them. All you have to do is when you go to them, call it out by name and tell it that you want to listen to Small Business Conversations with Tom Shea, and you will get to hear this particular recording. So, let me tell you what we're talking about tonight. Our subject tonight came up because of a newsletter. I like to read a lot of association newsletters, and this one came from a group that our guest is very familiar with called NBDA, which is the National Bicycle Dealers Association. And within the newsletter, there was commentary about this thing called ERC. I'm like, okay, what is this? So I find the wording, got the name for it and all, and as I mentioned in our announcement for tonight, a little concerned when I started searching for it online and seeing a whole lot of paid advertisements for businesses that we can help you with getting your ERC funds. Okay, let's just say I'm concerned with why are there so many people out there selling the service of doing it? What's going on here? So my first call goes to our guy that we love to talk to because he always brings us great information, and that's my good friend, Mike McCormick. So for those who have not been with us on the many times, I think Mike holds the record for most visits to Small Business Conversations, of which Mike was the first guest we ever had Small Business Conversations. So Mike is a certified public accountant, so you may hear us call him a CPA. He is an investment advisor representative of Financial Gravity Wealth Incorporated. He has 20 plus years as a CPA, and he also has been a dealer in the retail trade and served as the company's treasurer and controller. He has a lot of skill sets, dealing with things such as HR, benefits, the information technology, IT part, inventory control, financial management. The neat part is he's been an owner of a small business. So when we visit with Mike, he's able to take and speak right to what it is that we know, and it's we don't have that distance between us. I say us, speaking for all of us listening tonight as Mike is our guest, we don't have that distance between us, and many times we do with folks who have a technical aspect because he knows us, he's been there. So that being said, Mike, my friend, you are there?
Hey, Tom, I'm here. Thanks for having me again.
Well, I appreciate you being here. Appreciate you coming and donating your evening and come and share and give them some clarification as to just exactly what this thing is. So as we spoke a little earlier in the day, I told you I've been out looking, and I said, well, Mike, I've got 14 questions that I found about things like, well, it makes me wonder about this, and it makes me wonder about that. And I'm sure there are other people who have lots of thoughts about this. So let's just get right down to business. Let's get rid of the acronym, ERC. What is that?
It's one of those magic three-letter abbreviations that the tax code seems to be full of. The other one was PPP, or it came out about the same time. So PPP was the Paycheck Protection Plan or program, and then the ERC is the Employee Retention Credit. And the Employee Retention Credit, I'll hold off on that. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, so this, you're saying this came out at the time that everything started back in 2020.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So in 2020, you had competing government programs. You had the Paycheck Protection Program, which was set up as a forgivable loan based on wages paid to employees. The problem that we had with PPP was that it took so long to get the money to employers that many had already laid off their staff, and they had gone on unemployment, and they weren't going to come back until their unemployment ran out. But at the same time, the government came out with this program called the Employee Retention Credit, which had large numbers attached to it. The problem back then, at the beginning, was that if you received PPP money, you were ineligible for ERC money. So nobody really understood ERC right out of the gate. And because of the way the timing worked out, many companies had already applied for and received PPP money. So they thought they would be ineligible for ERC dollars. Well, come early 2001, Congress reversed itself and said, if you receive PPP money, that does not disqualify you from getting ERC credits. The problem became...
So now, is this like a form of double dipping? I mean, well, if you gave me PPP money to pay my employees, but now you're going to turn around and hand me money again because I kept those same employees?
Sure, that's a great question. And no, you're not quite double dipping. I mean, you're taking advantage. You might be able to take advantage of both programs, but the way the ERC is calculated, you first have to make an adjustment for PPP money that you received and was forgiven. So it's, you're not double dipping on the same dollars. It's possible that you received PPP money and ERC money on the same employee, but not on the same dollars. Okay? So it is possible that you could take advantage of both ERC and PPP.
Like a lot of government things.
Yeah. Well, it was incredibly confusing, and it came out in a time in my practice where there were new laws, new regulations, and probably more tax affecting legislation came out in that, I don't know, 6 month period or so than had really come out in the previous 5 or 10 years. And practices like mine were scrambling to get up to speed, help clients find the most beneficial program for them at the time, and then several things changed midway through. So, like I said, PPP initially prevented you from taking advantage of the ERC, and then they reversed themselves, and that happened a few times. Or the language of the legislation was contradictory or confusing, and it prevented people from taking action quick enough. to be able to save their staff. But both programs were designed to help employers keep people on payroll, keep people employed. Now, the problem was, one, the timing. So a lot of people had already gone on the unemployment rolls, and you weren't going to get them back because they didn't have to work to get the unemployment. Whereas if they came back to work, they theoretically had to work. But the way the PPP was set up, it was just a pass-through. The employer was just supposed to be the quickest way for the government to get money in the hands of the employee. But employers, being business owners, are not accustomed to paying people who are not doing work. ERC money is more directed towards the employer for keeping employees on payroll than a pass-through directly to the employee.
So is this like it's a reward for employers for having kept people?
Well, I can't say it's a reward, but it certainly, especially now, after the fact, because you can still apply for the ERC credits, and we're so far after the period where the wages were paid, employers are able to use this money to refill their coffers because they were paying employees potentially out of their own pocket, or maybe their business was still going strong, and this kind of allows them to bring some money in from the government that will allow them to expand or hire more employees, or hopefully those sorts of things.
Okay. So as I remember when PPP came out and we were looking at it from the standpoint of small businesses, there were some businesses, boy, and I guess I'm glad for them. I can't remember who it was. It seemed to me I was thinking it was a restaurant that had lots and lots of locations that got into the PPP money. Is there a size limit? I mean, so what are we looking for? It's like, do I have to have a certain number of employees minimum, and is there a certain number of maximum, or is there a top-end limit like gross revenue for a course of a 12-month period? Or how do we pick out which businesses are going to qualify for this?
Sure. The first thing is they had to keep people on payroll. So you have some issues there. One is the business had to remain open in some capacity to generate or to need to have employees there. To the extent that they had employees and were paying them, first they would have used PPP dollars to probably pay those employees. So from the employee's wages, we subtract the amount of PPP dollars the employer received for that employee, and then the additional amount can be used to apply for the ERC. The requirement is one employee. You know, it's not a lot of employees. Now, that employee, the way we understand the rule, is that employee cannot be related to the owner in almost any way. So it can't be the owner, it can't be the spouse, it can't be the kids, the parents, the brother, the cousin, no familial relationship. So you have a standalone employee. It could be a boyfriend or a girlfriend of a family member, but it can't be legal family.
As an owner, and if your brother is your manager of your business, so on and so, and at that point, it's I'm thinking about I have friends who have a business. It's a coffee shop, and everyone in the business is in the biological family. So from what you tell me, they're just out.
That's the way I read it, and that's the way attorneys that I work with have read it as well. It's if there's any familial relationship with the owner, then they're excluded. Now that can be interpreted in a couple ways. How do you interpret an owner? Well, it's someone who owns 50% or more of the business. Now, the way, again, it goes back to interpretation. The way that particular piece is written, it's confusing. It's not clear. And it's going to take 5 years before it goes to a court, and the court actually settles the definition of who is a 50% or more owner. I have a client, it's three siblings. Two siblings own 98%, and the other sibling owns 2%. But because of the family linkage, each owner is considered a greater than 50% owner. Because if I add one of the siblings to the other, it's greater than 50%. it's just a travesty the way that the law is written. It's just not clear who should be considered an owner or not, and beyond that, how they've defined what family is.
Okay, so now let me ask this. When you and I first spoke about this, you were expressing concern. You were addressing the issue I had of concern for all these people who are out there selling services, and now you've made this comment about it taking 5 years to go into the courts. So are you seeing that there's a possibility that someone's going to apply for this, get the money, but using your example of 5 years down the line, and it would go through the court system, that they're going to find themselves getting a letter from the IRS with, like, hey, guess what? We want that money back. Is that what you're foreseeing?
Well, I think you're going to see some of that, but consider this. The IRS has specifically expanded the statute of limitations on these things from 3 years to 6 years. Okay, so they are anticipating that a large number of the applications for ERC refunds are going to be examined, which means that they'll end up challenging a significant number of them. There are taxpayers out there who are being approached by these, we call them pop-up shops. You hear them on the radio. We're seeing them on TV now, that are touting that everyone's eligible, that everyone's eligible to get $26,000 per employee, and they're not really talking about the restrictions or the limitations. I've had clients contact our office wondering why we think they're not eligible. We explain it to them. Finally, we get them to understand it, but it's hard for an employer to pass on $26,000 per employee in what looks like free money. And I've told them you can apply for the employee retention credit and do the amended returns and you will get the money. That does not mean you're eligible to get the credit. So that's the thing. To apply for the credit, you're amending payroll tax forms for each quarter that were previously filed, and the IRS is going to process those as long as they're filled out reasonably accurately, correctly. The employer will get the money back. In addition to filing the amended payroll returns, the corporate returns also need to be amended to reduce the amount of payroll expense to the extent of the credit. So effectively, you're picking up income in 2020 and 2021, the years that the credit's available, to the extent that you reduce your expenses because you got the credit. These pop-up shops, in my experience, are not going back and amending those returns, and they're not notifying or letting the employer know that those need to be amended. So the employer is going to get...
Are they charging a fee?
Oh, yeah, sure. They're charging significant fees.
It's a flatener. They're charging you fees. It's not like, hey, if you win, it's not like the accident lawyers where if you win, we get this part of money. This is, I'm going to file this paperwork for you, and I'm getting a chunk of money?
It depends on the organization, I guess. I mean, I've seen anywhere from 25% of the ERC credit down to 5%, but I think most of them are getting the money once the employer receives the credit or receives the refund. I don't think they're getting paid up front, but they could be. I just don't know. It depends on which one you're looking at, probably. The problem is, okay, you get your refund and you pay the service provider. Are they going to be around in 6 years to defend you when the IRS comes to challenge your calculation? Now, the reality is most of the pop-up shops, if you do research on them, haven't been around very long. They're brand new entities. Are they going to be there to walk you through an IRS examination where you've received, you know, anywhere from a few thousand dollars to multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars? If you lose that credit, you have to pay it back, plus interest and penalties, plus you have to hopefully reamend your corporate returns to put the expenses back on there. Interest and penalties, probably substantial underpayment penalties. You want someone that's been in business for a while to work with you to apply for these credits. I mean, it's real.
Okay,
real
so let me
money.
Ask one more question, then we're gonna.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, one more question before we take a break here on this one. So you are filing this, you're getting the money back, but let me play devil's advocate with this question. You have told me the IRS is substantially understaffed, big time understaffed. And when I read articles online, I'm seeing these things about how long items are taking to be processed by the IRS. Not suggesting we're going to play dirty, but just asking a question out of curiosity and waiting for the usual Mike McCormick kind of giggle that I get when I ask these questions, like that right there. So what's the chances? What's the chances the IRS is really going to catch somebody?
Well, they've already started examining these. Now, I can't give you statistics specifically. I don't know if they're starting with the largest ones and working their way down, or if they're doing some sort of random sample. But by giving themselves double the time to look at them, I'm sure they're going to look at the largest ones, and then they're probably going to be looking at the ones that are a little more suspect. I don't know what that criteria is going to look like for the IRS, but you know, do you want to? It's like anything else with the IRS. You know, you're always subject to an IRS examination. But what are the odds? You know, one in four individual tax returns mm-hmm. gets looked at. One in a 0.25% of S corporations get looked at. I'm sure that your listeners have heard the media stories about the 87,000 IRS employees that are going to be hired, and gun-toting agents are going to be running the streets and all that kind of stuff. But you know, I've been telling people it's going to take them 10 years to hire 87,000 employees if they can find them. Have you tried to hire anybody lately? The other thing is, over the next 10 years, they're going to have 87,000 people retire. You know, the service levels.
So they're just breaking even.
Well, I don't know how many are going to retire. It's going to be a large number. Yeah, it's they're not going to be increasing their roles, I don't think. But the other issue is, the IRS is definitely behind. The practitioner hotline that we have access to generally takes anywhere from 1 to 10 tries to get through to someone. If you get through, sometimes you get hung up on after being on hold for an hour and a half to 2 hours. You can look up online the news stories of how backed up they were. They had millions of pieces of mailed correspondence in semi-trailers for months from the pandemic. There was a story about them destroying, I don't know, not remember the number off the top of my head, something like 1 million to 2 million documents just to get rid of them. Now, was that my client's tax return that was in there? I have no idea.
Mm. So we're going to take a quick station break. Let me tell everybody who our guest is. I'm thinking some of you are sitting there making notes and thinking, gosh, I got a bunch of questions that I want to ask. Okay, well, our guest is Mike McCormick. His company is Financial Clarity Group, and that's their website, Financial Clarity, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y, group.com. Phone number, 513-488-1121. And you can reach Mike by simply writing mike@financialclaritygroup.com. That easy. Okay, so quick station break. We'll continue.
This is PBN.
So our guest, Mike McCormick, is talking to us about the ERC. Let's see if I can pick it up a bit, Mike. I mean, I told you, I've got one, two, three. Yeah, I got four pages of questions and stuff. I'm trying to think of you. You made a comment about 20 and 21. So is that the time frame for which ERC is applicable?
Yeah.
Those two calendar years?
Well, not even full years. For most businesses, you're looking at second, third, and fourth quarter of 2020, first, second, third quarter of 2021.
Okay, so there are six quarters, none
in
this year.
Generally, that's correct.
That you, generally speaking, okay. So as you apply for ERC, are you applying for all of the 6 months? I mean, since that's, because at this point, there have been fourth quarter of 2021 and three quarters of 22, so you've got a whole year past it. Are you making a one-time, one application, or do you get to drag this out over a long period of time for your filing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's, as I said before, there's generally a three-year statute of limitations. So the second quarter of 2020 will be expiring in April of 2023. Okay, so that quarter, the second quarter of 2020, needs to be filed by the end of April of 2023. To answer your question, you're filing for a refund of each quarter's employee retention credit to which you're eligible. So there are six amended payroll tax returns and now two business tax returns that would need to be amended.
Okay. So can you, though, go ahead and file all of them now since it's all passed?
Oh, sure.
Can you say I'm going to amend my 2021, my 20, and all the quarters,
yeah,
and just,
yeah,
I'm going to do it one,
yeah,
time and I'm over with it?
Absolutely. The ones we've done all six quarters. We mail them in separate envelopes, and they get processed separately. So you might receive the credit for the second quarter of 21 before you get the second quarter of 2020 because of the way they process or hit their system. But yeah, they're filed. They're independent from the aspect of filing. Now, the rules were if you're qualifying based on a decline in revenue. So if we go back to 2020, if you had a 50% or greater reduction in your revenue as compared to the same quarter in 2019, then you qualified. So let's say the second quarter of 2020, your revenues went down more than 50% of what they were for the same quarter in 2019, you qualify, which means you automatically qualify for the third quarter because you automatically qualify for the subsequent quarter if you qualified for a quarter. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Now, if you qualified based on...
I've got...
Yeah, if you qualified based on... a restriction in trade, that's only good for the period of the restriction. There are two primary ways to qualify. One is a reduction in revenue, and the other is a restriction in business activity due to some government intervention.
Question just sent in, Mike, says, is there a max on how much the government has allocated for this program, which they... something in CARES Act before, I knew there was a, when the money's gone, it's gone. Or does this keep going until everyone who is eligible has been paid?
I think it's going to go until everyone who files gets paid. There are going to be businesses who are eligible that end up not getting their credit because they don't file.
Okay. You had said that while initially PPP money disqualified you from this program, that Congress changed it so that you could have qualified for, what about payroll protection? What was its PPP? I forgot.
PPP, payroll protection program.
Okay, so if you qualified for payroll protection program, you can at this point qualify for employee retention credit. Is there anything within all of that CARES stuff that came out that disqualifies a person in part or in whole from ERC?
Not that I can think of specifically, Tom. What qualifies you for ERC is, like I said, the reduction in revenue or a government intervention in preventing commerce in your business. The third way would be they call it a recovery startup business, somebody that started business in 2020. But I don't know of anything specifically in the CARES Act that would exclude someone. Now, I don't know if the CARES Act refined who a business owner, what the definition of a business owner is, but I don't think so.
Okay. All right, so let's ask you this one. This is called Employee Retention Credit. But from what I'm hearing you saying, this is a check that shows up in the mail?
Yeah, it's in IRS language, it's a refundable tax credit. So there are so if you think about how things get calculated, business expenses are good. They reduce your taxable income and therefore reduce the tax. But tax credits are a direct reduction in the tax itself. The issue is some tax credits are not refundable. In other words, they must be used to reduce your tax liability. So if you have no tax liability, you lose out on the credit. There are some tax credits that are both have a portion that's non-refundable and a portion that is refundable. And actually, the ERC has that characteristic. The example that I can use is the education tax credit. It's a $2,500 credit, but only $1,000 of it is refundable. The employee retention credit is similar. There's a non-refundable portion, which is if you're taking the ERC credit on an originally filed payroll tax return, it would just offset the employer tax. It's not refundable. But the other part of the employee retention credit is a refundable credit, and at this point, you're effectively getting the non-refundable back because you paid it, and you're getting the refundable back because you're filing for it.
Okay. Another question that just came in. Is it possible to qualify in some way even if your revenues did not decline?
Certainly. And I'll give you an example.
Explain that one to it?
Yeah, I'll give you an example in a moment. As I said, there are a couple ways to qualify for ERC. One is the decline in revenue. The other is some sort of government restriction in your ability to do business. Now, what is that? Well, if you think of a restaurant, the Board of Health prevented restaurants from having dine-in eating for some period of time. That's a government restriction in business. And then it moved to pickup only, or it moved to limited dining inside the facility. That was a government restriction. Another could be somewhere in your supply chain, one of your vendors wherever they are, had a government restriction on their ability to produce whatever it was that you bought from them, that would cause you to qualify. During the pandemic, a lot of outdoor activities took off. One would be golfing. A lot of golf courses have banquet facilities that were shuttered because the Board of Health wouldn't let people gather. You couldn't have large groups for the majority of 2020. So golf courses, the ones that I've seen, had more rounds played in 2020 than they had the prior 5 years in any one year. So the revenues were up.
Yes, very true.
Right? The revenues were up, but because they couldn't operate part of their business, they qualify. So all of the wages they paid for the people who were running the golf course, other than family, qualified for ERC.
Okay. So let me take your question in a slightly different direction, because you used golf. So let me throw a couple other at you. Bicycle shops and liquor stores.
Sure.
They both went gangbusters.
Right.
I mean, they didn't have a part of their business that closed. They were just
right.
selling them as fast as they could.
Right.
So going to our guest who's asking this question.
Yeah, I think you'd have to look at the supply chain. So is there – now you got to be careful because like the liquor store – and I'm just thinking about this off the top of my head. I mean, you might not have been able to get a particular flavor of gin or brand, but there was a suitable alternative that you could have bought. So I don't think that would prevent you from – I don't think that would qualify you. But if you were – if your main supplier was shut down because of some sort of COVID government restriction, then that might cause you to qualify. In the bike business,
might cause you to qualify or not qualify.
Well, if you're in the liquor store, if you're primary supplier of several types of liquor or brands of liquor or something like that, if they were disrupted because of a government shutdown, that might cause you to qualify. But if it comes down to, like I said, one particular type of liquor, I don't know that would be enough to qualify. It has to be substantial. So one brand of, like I said, gin or tequila or whatever not being available because they can't get it across the border or something like that, I don't know that that's enough to qualify you. You could substitute it with something else, in other words. So it has to be a significant part of your business. In the bike business, bicycle shop. So again, their sales probably took off. They would have to look at their supply chain. Is their primary supplier open for business the whole time? Did they have some sort of government restriction? Did the bike shop have some government restriction preventing all of their employees being able to report to work? Normally we have 15 okay. people here, but they said we can only have 3 at a time. Or something. I mean, it really is a case by case basis where it's not going to be a bright line where they qualify or not, and that again goes back to the 6-year statute of limitation. Your where you decide the cutoff is might not line up exactly where the IRS says it is, and you'd have to defend it.
Okay. Now before we take our 9 minute ago station break to give a drink of water there. You say government restriction. Now we're talking about state and local restrictions as to who's barking the orders.
Yeah, sure. Right?
We've seen one type of business open a state and another state that business can't open.
That's right. And that depends on on where your supplier might be. So you really have to do some research and see. You can think about, you'd have to go back to your records or in your memory to see, my primary brand of bikes, they couldn't ship me anything because the freight company was shut down. They're the primary company they use because of a COVID restriction in being able to ship or cross state lines or who knows what it might be. But that's something that the business owner is going to have to look at. And that goes back to a great point there, Tom.
We've got someone who's going to ask that in a second.
Well, I got
we've got someone who's going to ask us that question.
Okay. Well, there was a
go ahead.
Something that popped in my head about the pop-up shops. Most of the ones that we've seen are only looking at businesses that had a decline in revenue because it's a bright line. It's easy to determine. If you think you qualify due to some sort of government intervention in your business or your supply chain, most my experience so far, the pop-up shops aren't touching those because they're more risky, and there's no bright line that makes the definition or the qualification easy to determine.
Okay, now we'll take it. Well, let's take the 90-second break, and then I'll tell everybody who we're listening to, and then next thing we'll do is take the question that's posted on my board here from someone participating, and then in the last 17 minutes, we'll get to the rest of the questions. Here we go. Station break. Don't go away. We got more coming to you from Mike. Okay, 88-second break with a song called 88 Keys. Cute, right? Guest tonight, Mike McCormick, CPA. Here's where to find my friend Mike. 513-488-1121. FinancialClarityGroup.com. Email is mike@FinancialClarityGroup.com. I'm just endorsing. I've known this man for a whole bunch of years. He's very sharp. And if I have questions, this is a person that I want to ask questions of. I trust him, and that's the best endorsement I can give. I trust him. And I have a question for you, Mike. You may add additional thoughts to this one. It says, our business experienced significant product delays due to COVID restrictions. Lead times went from 3 to 4 weeks to 8 to 10 months. We were put on allocations unable to sell all we could have. That was killer.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And in some cases, it's still going on. The thing that you have to do is be able to tie the slow deliveries to some sort of government restriction. And that may or may not be easy to do. You may have to contact your vendors to find out what their situation was to determine whether or not that is substantial enough for you to qualify. Like I said, there's not going to be a bright line. in many of these cases where there's some sort of government restriction in your business, and it may not be obvious, but you've got to find, you might be able to find it or find several. Ideally, you find several, because the more you can document, the more likely you are to win an argument with the IRS. What I don't know is when they come looking at these, how diligent they're going to be at doing research, or are they just looking for people who filed for a refund or filed for the ERC based on the number of employees, but didn't do any don't have any background or backing information, documentation to support it. They just filed for the full credit and they got the money and hope they don't get looked at. But you should have documentation of why you believe you qualify, whether it's a reduction in revenue or a business startup due to some sort of government shutdown or limitation in someone's business. You have to document.
So in coming
document
up
it
with
and
these,
keep it.
Okay. And coming up with these items, what you're doing is like building a case for trial, and these letters are to serve as your witnesses, so that you would get letters from your vendors, and I'm thinking scan them, have a folder on the computer that's backed up somewhere, so you're not looking for some file folder that's now 6 years old, so that when you would file, and if the IRS came knocking on your door, your thinking is to have these letters there to say, here's what they're saying. For example, the guest who I just quoted a while ago comes back, and this is his comment. He says, in our case, several manufacturers were unable to obtain component parts and raw materials due to port closures and social distancing in the factories that slowed up the production as well.
Absolutely. Those are the things you need to document. How long did those government restrictions exist? And it's going to be different for each taxpayer. This is the kind of thing that most people don't pay attention to. You need to be able to document your business expenses. You know, if the IRS calls and say, we want to see the detail of your office expenses, a credit card statement isn't enough to corroborate that those are business expenses. You need the actual documentation from the companies that you bought this stuff from. This is kind of the same thing. It's keeping the documentation that you believe supports the decision you made to apply for the credit. It's really not any different. Now, is it going to be sufficient, what you collect? It's hard to say. You collect as much corroborating information as you can right now while you're doing the credit, not 5 days before the examiner comes and looks at the records. It's got to be done now, because, like Tom said, 6 years from now or 4.5 years when you get the letter, you're not going to remember.
Yeah, it's in a folder, or you filed it away with your tax return, and now which year did you file this? And
yeah, right, that, and you that, well, you want to make lost. Absolutely. You want to make sure you don't destroy that stuff, too, because a lot of people keep stuff 3 years to 5 years, and like I said, the statute is 6 years on this.
Yeah, I know a CPA who tells his clients that they're supposed to hold on to stuff for 7 years.
Usually.
Isn't that what you said?
Yeah.
You've been on
yeah.
the show in the past?
That's right.
Okay. Well, two things. One, the person who's asked a couple of questions says, thank you, very helpful. And for those who have not asked a question in the past who want to do it, or someone who wants to ask another one, if you look across the bottom of your screen, I think the screen I get to see, same type of screen everyone else is, across the bottom I have a gray bar, and one of the words in there is chat, a little like a thought balloon in the word chat. If you click on that, you can send a letter. And to the person who wants to ask this question, I can tell you the answer is yes. Okay, so does Mike advise clients from other states? Well, I know the answer is yes, so let me ask the question.
Tom's in Arkansas, so yeah. Yes, we do.
Oh, no, well, I asked this one, because I mean, I've known this with people who are in the insurance field. Can you do it in any state?
Yeah, there's a misunderstanding, I think.
I mean, I know insurance people have to be licensed in each individual state.
Sure. Now, my CPA license is issued by the state of Ohio. The IRS, as a federal matter, recognizes CPAs as being able to represent clients in front of the IRS regardless of what state they're in. The issue comes into solicitation. I cannot go into Kentucky and solicit business. I cannot go into Indiana and solicit business, or Missouri, or wherever. But clients are welcome to come find me, or prospective clients can seek me out.
Okay. The door swings one way. Has to come into you. You can't come out. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Pretty accurate.
So,
yeah.
To answer that one, the answer is yes. And to everyone, like I said again, if you want to ask a question, down below on my screen, it's purple, and underneath, just in black letters, says chat. You click on that, and you type in your question, and that's how it is that right now I'm carrying on conversations with several of you who are asking questions, and that's good because it's important that everyone get their piece of information taken care of. Mike, I'm down to my last couple of questions. So we might get done just under an hour, or we may go longer depending on what pops up on the screen. I, in doing my research, I found some things, a thing, another one of those acronyms, called ERTC. Is that something different?
ERTC.
And they didn't just type it once. It was in a bunch of things, and it kept saying ERTC, ERTC this.
I think they're doing that for marketing purposes. It sounds different. ERTC is Employee Retention Tax Credit. I think it's exactly the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. They're doing it to. My guess is they're doing it to create some sort of marketing advantage because nobody's heard of ERTC, and it sounds like something that. That they should be doing, but it's the same thing.
People like me would ask the question.
Right. It's the same tax credit.
Because it says companies looking to claim the ERTC must report their total qualified wages as well as the related health insurance costs on their quarterly tax return, the 941 for most folks. This refundable credit will be taken against the employer's share of Social Security tax.
Yeah, that's how you get the refund. But the ERTC and ERC are exactly the same thing. They're trying to differentiate themselves. Absolutely.
Okay. I have one last question. I'm expecting a little bit of the usual Mike McCormick giggle that comes with the my asking the question. With all that we have discussed in the last 53 minutes, with all the details you've shared with us, can a person, as a business owner, just go do the paperwork themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you're not out there fishing for business.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, you're not fishing for business, so I expect you would say, you're going to tell me, yeah, you can, and you know, but here's what you got to watch for, or don't make this mistake.
Could they? Yeah, sure. There's some big what-ifs in there. I mean, you're amending a payroll tax return that most employers have a payroll service do for them or have their CPA firm do for them. So they may not even ever see that form. It gets filed on their behalf. They may not even realize it exists. That's one. So you may not know where to report the refundable or non-refundable, and then it goes back to are you able to calculate accurately the refundable versus non-refundable portion of the credit after taking into consideration PPP dollars by employee for each pay period or each quarter, on top of do you qualify based on reduction in revenues or a business limitation, and then you have to amend the business return, the S-corp 1120S or the C Corp 1120 or the Schedule C or the partnership return. Is it possible? Sure, Tom. Should a business owner prepare their own tax return?
You're telling me that what I'm hearing and what I'm thinking about is I have engaged my CPA, my accountant, to do my tax return for me, and now am I going to take a shot at amending something that I just hired someone to do?
Yeah, that's part of it. Somebody asked me, can I do it myself? And I tell them, maybe. Do you want to take that risk? The thing is, this is beyond any engagement you may have on record with your tax professional. It's outside the scope of anything that we could have thought about ahead of time. So they're all standalone engagements to calculate and prepare the amended returns. It can be very time-consuming and challenging to get to the right number, and it's expensive.
Okay.
Just straight up, yeah.
Here's one more question. This comes from a good friend of mine up in your part of the country. She says, hello, Tom, and hello to you, my friend. Gosh, it's good to hear from you. says, how would you qualify for the ERC if you have a gas/truck station and your revenue went way up, but your fuel volume went way down because fuel prices went way up because of fuel supply and there were shortages? If the answer is supply chain issues qualify us, then how would we, the gas truck station retailer, prove or inform the IRS about the issue on the ERC?
Well, you're not going
now,
to. Yeah.
Here's another one, though. Here's a bit more comes from this. Let me go get through all these. Most firms are charging 15 to 20% of the awarded amount. Is that a normal range? If I can negotiate the terms, what is a fair or realistic for me to ask? And this person says, great topic, Tom. Thank you for inviting Mike to be on the call.
Well,
so take those in line, and sure. We'll see if any of our questions come in while you're answering this.
Sure. On the trucking depot, it's not so much that you're trying to prove up front or send something to the IRS. That's going to happen on the back end, where they might look at the payroll tax returns that get filed to receive the credit. How would you qualify? You'd have to document that the slow delivery or the limited availability of the product, the fuel, was due to some sort of government restriction in your vendor's ability to get the fuel to you. What might that look like? A shutdown at the refinery because of COVID, or they had to limit the number of employees that were working the refinery due to COVID, so that slowed down production. You're going to have to dig to try to uncover that. I don't know and the other thing is, if one supplier's fuel is slowed down, was there another viable source that you could have gone to instead? If there was, I would tend to say you may not be eligible. If there wasn't another supplier, or not a supplier that would be able to provide the product in a reasonable amount of time, then maybe you do qualify. But it's going to be documenting what happened to your vendor.
Would deal with this one, Mike. If you've got a contract with a vendor, okay? Let's say that this business, okay, the gas truck station, okay, we're talking a fueling station, has a contract with, let's say, Shell. Your contract says you're selling Shell fuel and you got the Shell sign up. You can't go around to another vendor and say, I'll just go buy it from them. You've probably got a contract that says, I can't touch it.
Right. I understand. And that those are the kinds of things that you have to look at on a case-by-case basis. And it goes back to what I about the liquor store. If you can't get vodka from Jose Cuervo, but you can get vodka from Grey Goose, as far as the IRS is concerned, that's a viable alternative. That's not because you can't get Jose Cuervo. You don't have a restriction in you don't have a dramatic enough, significant enough restriction in your business to qualify just because of that one brand. In the fuel example, I grew up in Lima, Ohio, and we have a refinery there. I think it's a Husky refinery now, but I don't know what sort of restrictions they had on producing gasoline during COVID, but there may have been some. So there may have been a restriction in the number of employees that could be in the facility at any one time, which slowed down the production of fuel that then got out to the truck stops. That I don't know. That's something the business owner would have to do some research on.
Okay, so let me throw this one quick one because we've passed our hour, but we got good stuff going here. In the liquor industry, one of the biggest shortages they had was peach flavored Crown Royal. Okay, well it's peach flavored Crown Royal. There ain't peach. You know,
Bird Dog is better anyway.
Peach flavored somebody something. But so you like this thing called Bird Dog as compared to Crown Royal. But if that's the product people are looking for, they're not looking for a vodka. They're looking for peach Crown Royal.
Right.
You know, is this again what you're telling people? It's you document. Look, this is what I have. It's on allocation. I can't get it.
Well, that again, it's magnitude. How much has the inability to get that particular brand impacted your business? And I would argue that while it may not be immaterial, it's not enough to rise to the level of being significant in your overall business.
Okay. All right. So we'll make this the last question of the night, going back to the one from my friend. She was asking that firms that she has already been talking to are looking for 15 to 20% of the awarded amount. Of course, you've already made the comment about, you know, if they're getting 15 to 20%, they're getting it out of what you get now. And if you get disqualified down the line, your only chance of going after them is if they are still there in business. But her follow-up question is, that, you know, is that normal from what you've heard? And is that something that you would negotiate? Would there be a number you'd throw out? What's your thought?
Sure. I can't knock a company for attempting to get as much as they can to do a service. The issue is making sure that they do the full job. Make sure that they document the. Have documentation of how they came to the conclusion that they did and that they provide it to you so that you have it. Make sure that the corporate returns are covered in the engagement. Now, it could mean that you have to go back to your CPA firm or your whoever the preparer is, and they have to work together with the ERC company to amend those corporate returns. I would say somewhere between 5 and 20% would be reasonable.
Okay.
But I would also say it would be negotiable for just about any vendor that you're talking to. You know, because the numbers will be significant, okay. and the amount of work that they're going to do for you with 25 employees. Whether the ERC is 60,000 or 250,000 is going to be about the same. And the other part is make sure the engagement letter that you have for these has some sort of callback. So if the IRS does come back and take away or make you repay 50% of the credit that you received, that the firm that did the work refunds 50% of their fee.
Good point. So, Mike, as I close, I'm going to remind you of when you and I spoke about this somewhere in the last month and decided to do the program. You were the one who said, "You know, I'm not so sure there's a whole lot we could talk about for an hour."
Yeah, I thought 20 minutes would about cover it.
Well, but you see all the questions. All right, so here, let's get to the one important detail, and then I'll two items. Number one, next Small Business Conversation is going to be December the 1st. There's not one on a Thursday night in November, and simply because I'm not in an office at all for all of the month of November. It's a trade show, which I'm thankful for every time that I've got to be somewhere. So December 1st will be the next show. I'll announce soon who's going to be the guest. Mike McCormick, everybody right? Got your pencils handy. 513-488-1121. 513-488-1121. His company is Financial Clarity Group. Clarity is C-L-A-R-I-T-Y. Email is mike@financialclaritygroup.com. And with that, Mike, I'm going to send you home to your lovely wife, Kelly. Tell her thank you so much for letting us have you for an hour on your Thursday night. We appreciate that. Glad you could come back again. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you
everyone,
for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I appreciate your help, Mike.
Yep.
Everybody, thanks again. Good night, everybody.
It has been our pleasure to share fresh ideas and trends from premier small business owners, coaches, and resources. Join Tom Shea and guests next month right here on Small Business Conversations from Profits Plus Solutions. This is PBN, the Profitable Business Network. Visit our website to learn more about us at profitsplus.org. There you will find our catalog of small business conversations, articles and advisories, news, meeting planners, calculators, and resources. Also, we invite you to connect with Profits Plus Solutions on our various social media channels. Please like or connect with us on Facebook, LinkedIn, SlideShare, Twitter, and YouTube. We have links to all our social media channels on our homepage at profitsplus.org. Thank you for joining us.